Today is Monday, October 19th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, elderly voters are a key demographic in the U.S. presidential race.
He is losing seniors in many states, often by very substantial margins. That's a result of downplaying the coronavirus pandemic while seniors are the most vulnerable population.
Also ahead, fears of extremist violence around the vote, plus a look at protests in Thailand, Colombia, and Chile. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is the U.S. election campaign. On Friday, President Donald Trump campaigns in Florida, a state with one of the highest populations of elderly voters, promising that he would protect American seniors from the pandemic. Trump handily won senior citizens' votes in 2016, but latest polls show that Democratic nominee Joe Biden is leading by a significant margin among Americans 65 and older. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suara has the story.
This senior community in Florida is traditionally a Republican stronghold, but after the Democratic National Convention in August, some residents paraded in support of Joe Biden, saying they have had enough of President Donald Trump.
We want everybody to know that we need to get him out of office.
Polls show Trump is losing support from voters 65 and older, a group he won by 9 percentage points in 2016. Republican strategist Whit Ayers.
He is losing seniors in many states, often by very substantial margins. That's a result of downplaying the coronavirus pandemic while seniors are the most vulnerable population.
Eager to win back older voters who make up 23% of the 2020 American electorate, on Friday, Trump campaigned in Florida in an event billed protecting American seniors.
I will defend you and I will fight for you with every ounce of energy and conviction that I have.
Trump repeated a promise he made days after his release from hospital due to COVID, saying seniors will get the same experimental drugs that he received.
We're going to make it available to everyone who needs it for free.
While the pandemic is a factor in polling, senior support for Trump has slipped since mid-2019. One possible reason, retirees now see him as a more extreme candidate than they did 4 years ago. Robert Griffin is the research director for the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group.
More moderate candidates tend to win higher shares of the vote. So this is true of all voters in the first place. Among seniors, this is also a more moderate portion of the electorate.
Biden also traveled to a senior center in Florida this week to court older Americans.
Because Donald Trump, it's simple. Not a joke. You're expendable. You're forgettable. You're virtually nobody. That's how he sees seniors. That's how he sees you.
Trump recently tweeted a Photoshop meme of his opponent in a wheelchair surrounded by seniors. The 74-year-old president often mocks Biden, who is 77, calling him Sleepy Joe. Chris Cooper is a professor of political science at Western Carolina University.
Trump has doubled down on the idea that Joe Biden isn't functioning well anymore, simply that he is too old, implying with no evidence that he has dementia. And of course, this doesn't play very well with a senior audience.
Who's better for seniors?
Still, the Trump campaign is not giving up on seniors, launching ads targeting older voters in key battleground states this week. Patsy Whitaker-Suara, VOA News.
Also in the U.S., the arrest of 13 men accused of conspiring to kidnap a state governor is raising fears of election-related violence. For VOA, Matt Dibble reports.
Open up! Open up! Last spring, protests erupted in the U.S. over pandemic safety measures. At rallies on the Michigan Statehouse lawn in April and May, some protesters expressed desperation over loss of income, while others were incensed by what they considered to be an abuse of power by Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat. Some protesters even brought guns into the statehouse.
If we didn't bring up firearms, these people wouldn't be protected, and the government could do as much overreach as they want.
Last night, the FBI and Michigan State Police.
Last week, 13 men were charged with conspiring to kidnap the governor to try to incite a violent insurrection ahead of the November election. Several of the men arrested had been regulars at the anti-lockdown rallies, events organized and supported by well-connected political operatives on the right, according to Lisa Graves, who leads a public policy research group.
You had very established groups helping some groups that were more on the fringes, less well-established. These right-wing groups in the United States who were pushing to try to overturn those orders and calling it tyranny. And not just them, but the president of the United States. That sort of rhetoric can embolden people who may have a predisposition toward violence.
Just last week,
after the arrests, Governor Whitmer called out President Donald Trump for stoking distrust and fomenting anger. Trump responded by tweeting he does not tolerate extreme violence and that Governor Whitmer has done a terrible job. Seven of the men charged were members of an anti-government militia that recruited and communicated using Facebook. And although Facebook alerted the FBI to the group's inflammatory statements, experts like Joan Donovan say the social media companies do not always keep up with the threats.
For me, it's more of a warning sign that there are other groups that are potentially harboring such plans. And if the companies that have built these rails to shuttle information around aren't aware of the cargo, then it puts the public at much greater risk.
The year has also seen protests over police killings of Black citizens erupt across the country, with some outbreaks of property damage, looting, and clashes with counter-protesters. FBI Director Christopher Wray recently addressed the escalating threat of extremism in testimony before Congress.
Although the majority of protesters have been peaceful, we have opened investigations on individuals involved in criminal activity at these protests, some of whom adhere to violent extremist agendas designed to sow discord and upheaval.
Early voting is already underway in much of America, and the FBI is trying to reassure Americans about the security of the election and urging people to report suspected federal election crimes or voter intimidation. Matt Dibble for VOA News.
For more on the campaigns as the U.S. elections approach, earlier today I spoke to VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman on what Donald Trump and Joe Biden are up to.
Jason, the president's making two campaign stops in the state of Arizona on Monday. The reason for that is the state is really close. It's going to be a challenge for the president to pick up the electoral votes of Arizona. If you average out all the polls taken this month, the major credible polls, they're showing Biden up about 3%. Now, that's pretty close to the margin of error for polls. So we can say that Arizona is really running neck and neck. And Arizona is a fascinating state. It's in the American Southwest. It's a young state. It does have a heavy Latino population, but it's also been a conservative Republican bastion for decades. It also has an image as a place with a lot of moderates. And in the Republican Party in recent years, we had two standing U.S. senators from the Republican Party who came out against Donald Trump, John McCain, who's passed away, another senator, Jeff Flake. So there is a bit of an independent streak in that state. And also what is being closely watched and one thing that the president wants to do while he's in Arizona is to try to bolster the incumbent Republican Senator Martha McSally. She is trailing in the polls to Mark Kelly, an astronaut, a Democrat. He's the husband of a former congresswoman from the Democratic Party who had to leave office after she was shot in the head at an appearance with constituents. So a lot of popularity for him. And definitely that's something that Trump wants to do in Arizona as well, is try to help the Republicans hold on to the Senate, because about a half a dozen seats for the Republicans are endangered. And it's very possible the Republicans could lose control of the U.S. Senate. And the Democrats are expected to retain the House. So then the Democrats would be in charge of both chambers of Congress.
Now, over the weekend, Trump campaigns in the state of Michigan, where there was recently a foiled plot to kidnap the Democratic governor, At Trump's rally, the crowd started chanting "lock her up" in reference to Governor Whitmer, and he responded by saying "lock them all up." What's happening with that, and what's been the response from Governor Whitmer?
Right. Well, the president had made some comments which were seen as a further adding fuel to the fire instead of very strongly condemning this foiled plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Whitmer. And then very quickly on social media and on television, she went on the air to further criticize the president, accusing him of enabling what a number of people are calling domestic terrorists. So a real feud going on this close to the election between the Democratic governor of Michigan and the president.
And what about Biden? What's Biden been doing lately in his campaign?
He did make a stump speech in North Carolina on Sunday. He is not out on the campaign trail. He is preparing for the debate later this week, which will be the second. It was supposed to be the third with Donald Trump, the two going one-on-one on national television. So he is staying in Wilmington, Delaware, his hometown, to do debate prep. But leaving the campaigning for the day, at least, up to his running mate, Kamala Harris.
That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaking to me earlier today. This is VOA. In Thailand, thousands of protesters took to the streets Monday despite a fresh government warning, AFP reports. Earlier Monday, Thailand's embattled Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha said Parliament, currently in recess, would be recalled to discuss how to reduce tensions and warned protesters not to break the law. Also, in a bid to quell the protests, Thai authorities on Monday threatened to censor news coverage. They also raided a publishing house and attempted to block the Telegram messaging app used by demonstrators, the AP reports. The largely leaderless protest movement wants Prayut to resign and the rewriting of Thailand's military-drafted constitution. In Bolivia, socialist candidate Luis Arce looks set to win Sunday's presidential election, Reuters reports. An unofficial count indicated Monday that Arce had 52% of valid votes, while his centrist rival Carlos Mesa had just 31%, with 5% of the votes counted. If the trend holds, it would put the left-wing party of exiled former President Evo Morales on the brink of a return to power. Morales resigned and fled the country last year after a disputed election sparked bloody protests. An unelected conservative government has held power since. This year's election was seen as a test of the country's democracy. And in China, official data released Monday indicated the country's gross domestic product grew 4.9% in the third quarter from a year earlier, Reuters reports. That's slower than the 5.2% analysts forecast in a Reuters poll, but it's faster than the second quarter's 3.2% growth. China suffered its first economic contraction in nearly three decades earlier this year because of the COVID-19 outbreak, but China is now the only major world economy expected to report growth in 2020. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thousands of indigenous protesters in Colombia have reached the capital, Bogota, after marching across the country. They want a meeting with President Iván Duque. For more, earlier today I spoke to journalist Megan Janetsky in Colombia's second city of Medellin.
Earlier in October, a group of indigenous tribes in the southwest of Colombia, which is historically violence-torn, but especially getting hit really hard by armed group violence now in the pandemic, they had a meeting with higher ministers of the Colombia's national government, but they really wanted an audience with the president, which did not happen. So they decided, instead of protesting as they normally do in that specific region of Colombia, that they were going to get up and essentially caravan to the country's capital of Bogota. Now we're seeing thousands of indigenous protesters caravanning to the country's capital of Bogota to make demands with the country's president. And among those demands are essentially policy that will actually diminish violence in this territory.
Now, it seems they've arrived in Bogota. What's it like there?
Yeah, so they reached Bogota yesterday, and you have to imagine these protesters are in massive buses called chivas, which are like colorful Colombian buses. They're in cars. They're going along all of these freeways, and now they're camped out near the center of the city. They're supposed to arrive and protest in the city's main square, Plaza Simón Bolívar, outside government offices today and potentially Wednesday, when other protesters are supposed to restart a national strike against the government.
And what exactly are their demands?
Their demands are fairly simple. They're protesting this surge in violence we've seen across the country. Colombia has seen a surge in really, really stark violence, like massacres and killings of social leaders. And this is disproportionately affecting indigenous in a lot of ways, because a lot of this violence is happening in these highly indigenous populated regions.
And has the president responded? Will he meet with the protesters?
So the president sent high-level advisors to the region of Cauca to meet with them. And they essentially said that wasn't enough, that they want to have a one-on-one conversation with the president. And he hasn't declined to meet them. They say they're open to dialogues, but at the same time, I would say based on past protests and past experiences, it's very unlikely that any sort of productive dialogue might happen. I'd also add that Bogota's mayor, which is traditionally the second most powerful position in the country, Claudia Lopez, has welcomed the indigenous and is pushing for the national government and Duque to actually meet with the indigenous people.
That was journalist Megan Janetsky in Colombia's second city of Medellin. More on protests in South America, this time in Chile, where tens of thousands gathered in the central square of the capital, Santiago, to mark the one-year anniversary of mass protests that left over 30 dead and thousands injured. Gloria So of Reuters has the story.
Tens of thousands of Chileans protested in the streets of Santiago over the weekend, demanding government reform. It marked the one-year anniversary of mass protests that left over 30 dead and thousands more injured. What started as largely peaceful rallies on Sunday soon devolved into violence, as demonstrators threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at police, who answered with water cannons and tear gas. Even churches were set ablaze by vandals as rioting and looting gripped the city by nightfall. Earlier in the day, people began gathering at demonstrations downtown and cities throughout Chile, which gained in size and fervor as the afternoon wore on. Many protesters waved signs and homemade rainbow-colored banners, asking Chileans to vote yes on a referendum to scrap the country's dictatorship-era constitution. That was a key demand of last year's protests, which raged on for nearly 2 months, as people across the country called for reforms in healthcare, education, and the pension system. And as the violence resurfaced late on Sunday evening, Chile's Interior Minister Victor Perez praised the peaceful rallies while blasting the late-night mayhem. He instead called on Chileans to settle their differences by voting in the upcoming referendum on October 25th.
Thanks to Gloria So of Reuters for that report. A UN arms embargo on Iran expired Sunday despite U.S. objections. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed the implications of the expiration and how the U.S. might respond with David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University.
Their priority is first air defense, so that's the S-400, which, by the way, was not affected by the sanctions. They were always allowed to buy defensive weapons. The second, I think, would not be aircraft. I think if they buy aircraft, it'll just be a small number. They can't recapitalize the Shah's Air Force because they don't have the money. But I think it's disruptive technologies, primarily anti-ship missiles that they would use to keep the U.S. Navy and allied navies at a distance. They build their own missiles for use against surface targets, but they still need anti-ship missiles. So that, I think, will be the major one, probably the Russian Bastion system and perhaps additional purchases of some of the Chinese anti-ship missiles.
Would that create some sort of arms race in the region?
There's already kind of an arms race in the region that's driven more by issues of prestige and national pride than cold assessment of security threats. So all the countries in the region have, or many of them have, air forces that are really out of whack with their security priorities. Most of the threats to security in these areas is internal, or it is, you know, things like ocean, air defense, stuff like that. But all of the countries in the region, with possible exception of Oman, have sort of overinvested in air-to-air combat. So I don't think it'll get much worse. I think that there will be a market to buy additional missile defense systems.
Lifting the arms embargo on Iran would also enable Tehran to sell arms and missiles. How serious is that to the regional security?
Well, that's actually a global security threat potentially, because Iran does have a robust domestic missiles industry. What they've done is they reverse engineered North Korean missiles, which were basically Russian missiles, but they've actually moved beyond that. They haven't really made any huge scientific leaps, but they've made significant engineering leaps, things like they're now building missile bodies out of composites. There's indication that they probably would seek to transfer these.
So what could the U.S. do to counter the expired UN embargo, especially that arms sales could be conducted by trade exchange and not necessarily using monetary systems?
Yeah, well, U.S. sanctions are most effective when they're directed against monetary systems, just because that's easier for us to identify and control, because the dollar remains the dominant currency and will remain for the foreseeable future. It's harder if they move into barter stuff, but the entities that engage in barter and things like banks that provide banking services for an entity that would barter commodities for weapons, those are still subject to sanctions. So the ability of the United States to apply sanctions and to identify individuals who have breached U.S. sanctions, that has increased exponentially in recent years. And the Trump administration has really made that a national security tool.
That was David DeRoche, associate's professor at the U.S. National Defense University, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy. That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 1st, the anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, has become a date to protest in Hong Kong against China's efforts to deprive the island city of its autonomy and fundamental freedoms. This year, Hong Kong's government banned a protest march by the pro-democracy Civil Human Rights Front and deployed some 6,000 police to patrol the streets. Several hundred people showed up to protest anyway, and police arrested 86. State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortegas expressed outrage at the Hong Kong government's arbitrary arrest of peaceful protesters. Other Hong Kongers expressed their dissent by openly reading the pro-democracy paper Apple Daily, sometimes in front of police, according to press reports. The newspaper's founder, Jimmy Lai, was arrested in August under the draconian national security law. The national security law was passed in June and punishes anything China deems as subversion, separatism, terrorism, or collusion with foreign forces, with up to life in prison. Protesters also called for the return of 12 Hong Kong citizens who were arrested at sea by Chinese authorities in August as they tried to escape to democratic Taiwan. Some of them faced serious charges for their pro-democracy activities. Chinese authorities have refused to return the 12 to Hong Kong and waited over a month before charging them. They have not been allowed to communicate publicly or meet with lawyers of their choice, according to press reports. We deplore the local authorities' continued use of law enforcement for political purposes, said Ms. Ortegas, which is contrary to the preservation of the rule of law and respect for human rights, including the rights to assembly and free expression. These arrests again underscore Beijing's complete dismantlement of one country, two systems that the People's Republic of China promised to uphold. A stable and prosperous Hong Kong depends on honoring the rights of assembly, free speech, and other fundamental freedoms. By repressing peaceful public opinion, the Hong Kong government once again shows its complicity with the Chinese Communist Party's evisceration of Hong Kong's autonomy and freedoms of its people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.